Today, there are over 1 million tribal members residing on American Indian reservations, 40% of whom live in homes that do not meet the federal standards for adequate housing. This compares to just 6% of the rest of the U.S. population living in substandard housing. These conditions can exacerbate and even cause chronic health conditions, making it difficult to be productive at work or at school. Not having a healthy home is a root cause of numerous problems that put a strain on community resources. Today, we are talking about solutions, and we're excited that all of us get to hear from someone that makes sure there are changes coming about. So please be sure to stay with us. Hello, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Impact Earth Energy. So let's start with this. A big thank you to the Agnes Helms Howery Program in Environmental and Social Justice at the University of Arizona for their partnership, for all the great work they do, and for making this show possible. We appreciate it and them. Now on to what I know is going to be a content-rich and informative show. Joining me is the person who is going to make sure that happens. No pressure, Joe. His name is Joe Seidenberg. He's the executive director of Red Feather Development Group. Red Feather partners with American Indian nations to develop sustainable solutions to the housing needs within their communities. They are currently serving the Hopi tribe and Navajo Nation in Arizona. Joe, I hope you can tell by my intro, it's really great to have you here for lots of reasons. One of them is my obsession with the history of American Indians and our treatment of them. So it's like, it's going to be a party. Let's do it.
That sounds great.
Okay.
Looking forward to the conversation.
Me too. So let's start with the story, because the storytelling is really what's in, and it's what I said in the intro, and it bears repeating. 1 million tribal members live on reservations. 40% live in homes that lack basic things that we take for granted, like running water and electricity, compared to 6% of the rest of the population. So what is the story? What are the federal standards? How are these people living? Just give us the overall, paint the picture for us of what it's like, the landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. And the story has been there for quite a long time, and well before Red Feather, but our organization started 25 years ago when our founder, Robert Young, had read about tribal elders literally freezing to death in their homes on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And that so motivated him and so shocked him to hear that in our own country, people were dying in their homes due to the poor condition, He had gone out and he met this tribal elder. Her name was Catherine Redfeather, hence the name of our organization today. We took her name because she was one of the first people we helped. And what he saw on that reservation, it's the eyes that really tell the stories. We can look at all the statistics. It's easy to Google and get online and look at some of the shocking data that exists out there. But it's really only a part of the story, and it's really inconclusive. Census data that tells us what's happening is very inaccurate, unfortunately. And it's a lot of that has to do with the mistrust of American Indians, of the U.S. government, the information that they're willing to share, and the U.S. government's ability to get accurate data. But if you go and drive across any American Indian community, maybe the Hopi Reservation here in Arizona, Navajo, you can see with your own eyes what's happening. Personally, myself, I'm going into houses all the time on a weekly basis. I enter homes, and at Hopi, as a specific example, one of the things that shocks me is I'll walk into a house and for windows, many people have cardboard or plywood up on their windows because their windows have been broken and they haven't been able to fix them. You see entire ceilings and walls covered in black dust. That black dust is coming from coal smoke that people were using to heat their homes, or even wood. Lack of electricity and plumbing. You know, you're in houses, and people have just learned to live with it, which is what's surprising. They're still very much so enjoying their lives and appreciating their families. And they've just, because they have been unable to access resources to get help in their homes, and because of the lack of employment opportunities, the remoteness of the places they live, that they're not able to access resources or to have the income to take care of their homes.
You know, it's so interesting as I sit here listening, like passionately listening, if that's such a thing. And what you wove into that is seeing people, like really, like I see you, that kind of thing, like from Avatar, I see you. And then weaving into it things that I learn about you, which is an observation of their culture as it really is. They are still happy. They have celebrations. They live in family units under conditions that would make you and I absolutely and positively miserable. And it's what you're used to. And it's just, it makes me really, really sad. And I know that might sound pithy, but it does. It's like, are you kidding me? With all the wealth in this country, there's anybody living without electricity? It's a tough one for me. I'm kind of obsessed. And then the next question I was going to ask you, which I hope you can answer, more about the impact on their lives and their health. But even more so, Joe, climate change is not coming. It's not coming soon to a theater near you. It's being lived out by people in lots of tribal communities whose land is virtually disappearing, like literally and figuratively and really because of, you know, rising tides. I just did a show with a friend of mine, Mary Gus, who's an attorney, representing, working with some of the tribes on, you know, relocation. But when you talk about the impact of that on their health, on going to work. First of all, burning coal inside their homes, is that what you said? We all know what coal does to us. So what kind of impact do you observe on their health and why it's important for all of our sakes to move that needle forward?
Absolutely. And sometimes it can be, we see lots of health disparities specific to coal and indoor air quality, which is a major concern in American Indian communities in general, and especially in the Southwest with coal-burning communities like Navajo and Hopi communities. Alaskan tribes also have, there's a lot of data around the poor indoor air quality in their homes. And one of the statistics that I commonly cite is that American Indian communities have doubled the asthma rates of non-native communities. And, you know, of course, indoor air quality is a contributing factor to that. And, you know, it's unfortunate. There's other things that we've seen. Bell palsy is another condition.
You're kidding.
There's a lady that we just recently helped with. She had come to us, and she was in desperate need of a new roof. And when we visited her house, the entire inside of her roof was covered in black mold. Now, some people can live with mold, and it can have no effect on them whatsoever. Other people can create respiratory issues on a minor level. It can create severe asthma issues on a higher level. And in some rare instances, there's a lot of, you know, folklore out there around mold that it can be deadly, and it can be. In this instance, it wasn't a toxic mold, but it was definitely influencing her health. Whether it caused the Bell's palsy, we don't know. But when we went into her house, we were floored, and we ended up having to do, we did a crowdfunding campaign for her. She was kind enough to share her story with us about her life. And, you know, why she was in the situation that she was in. And we shared that with friends of Red Feather, and we were able to raise enough money that we could go in and we could mitigate all the mold, tear out and essentially then all of the inside of her ceiling and put a brand new roof on her house. And she's just one example. Roofing and mold issues are very pervasive in Hopi and Navajo communities. Part of it has to do with the construction methods that people have used, sometimes faulty construction methods, often, or the materials that they're using. They just can't afford high-end, high-quality materials, or even finding proper labor to install the roofs correctly. And you get a minor roof leak, you ignore it, or, you know, you're like, I don't have $300 to patch that roof leak, and that $300 slowly starts turning into thousands and thousands of dollars, to the point that it's way beyond anything they could contemplate resolving themselves. I've been in homes, another lady that we helped who went into her house, and she had so many roof leaks inside the house. Her solution was to hang plastic sheeting on the inside of her house to funnel all of the water into one spot, and she had a 50-gallon drum to catch the water that was coming into her house. And to her, this was a great idea because, you know, it made it a lot easier versus having 20 buckets spread across the house that she would constantly have to take out. This way, she just had to dump the one bucket out. And for this lady, we didn't have to do any crowdfunding. She had a nephew that was able to repair her roof, but they came to Red Feather, and the only thing they asked us for was a generator and several air guns, nail guns, that they could use in the construction process, in the repair process of their home. So it was we liked that situation in that we were able to, it was a real good partnership with that family, in that we just provided a few things, and they did the rest of the work themselves and were able to take care of the situation.
So I have to ask you this. They had to ask you for a generator because the house didn't have electricity?
That's correct. They didn't have electricity. But I do think it's important to note around electricity, and specifically at Hopi, that there are certain villages, for folks that aren't familiar with the Hopi Reservation, that have, for cultural and religious reasons, have chosen not to have electricity, at least not in the conventional sense, with they don't want power lines going overhead. If they had access to solar, families in the communities that have kind of a rule against overhead power lines, if they can get access to solar, they have it. But solar is expensive. It has very high maintenance costs. And so, you know, we are looking where we can for opportunities to bring solar to those families that are interested in it, but it's not a cheap thing to do.
No, and it's so spread out. I mean, it's just the you know, this conversation could shut me down, but then that would leave you up the creek, and I'm not going to do that to you. It's like I can't even handle this because of the privilege that I live. And I am so very aware of that. And so I personally work to do what I can to make changes, like even this podcast to get the word out. But when you're describing a home that has to use big pieces of plastic for the leaks in the roof, that is absolutely and positively third world. That's what you see in India. And here it is right up north from where I live. It's like unconscionable. And it's out of sight. So for most people, it's out of mind. And for some people, it's too painful. It isn't too painful for me. I feel the pain and do it anyway. But so there's impact on their health. So if a mom is sick, she can't get out of bed or whatever, it impacts the kids' education. What do kids do for homework? If they have to read in our techno-driven world, what do they do? Do they use candles? I mean, I want to know exactly, if you don't have electricity, how do you study?
Yeah, absolutely. So families will use candles that don't have electricity. More commonly, I've seen families using kerosene lanterns.
Got it.
You know, and kerosene, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Africa, and I used to have to use a kerosene lantern in my village. So kind of similar to the comment you just
made.
Third world. But, you know, kerosene, again, back to indoor air quality, or what we say IAQ for short, kerosene emits gases and smoke that can go into the house. I personally haven't had a ton of experience with hearing families saying they aren't able to study at night, but I know it is quite pervasive, even more so perhaps on Navajo. I've seen another smaller Navajo individual, and I wish I could recall his name right now, but he's going across the Navajo Nation, and he's installing, they're essentially, they're called Goal Zero, and they're solar lanterns, and they allow you to have a few basic lights in your home that can provide lighting to children, so you can do your homework in the evening, or you could cook. You can cook in the kitchen. They allow you to plug in a cell phone. So I know some technologies like those products exist. We've installed one of those systems in one house at Hopi. So there are options available. People in the communities, they could go to a community center if they're open at night and potentially have light.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. You know, like, it's not having electricity in the home or not having plumbing. They definitely make life more difficult. But people are getting by. They're surviving those things to a degree. I personally think, like, things like not having a solid roof on a home and having it filled with mold or the risk of freezing to death or having to wear, you know, a winter coat and a stocking cap in your house really can make things more challenging, because then if you can't get a good night's sleep or if your immune system is compromised because of your house, then your ability to do well in school, as you said at the beginning of the podcast, to excel in work, just your overall mental health can be challenged. And just, you know, make living what we that don't live on the reservations perceive as absolutely normal. You know, it's a luxury for some people to have those things.
And it's such a point well taken. I mean, the basics, I think about flushing the toilet and turning the lights on, but it all starts with having a roof over your head. You have to have four walls and a roof for any of that to go on, because I wouldn't care if I could flush the toilet if snow was coming down through the roof. Seriously.
Yeah, or no windows.
Yeah, or no windows. Yeah. I can't even. That's all I can say. So I covered all the dark, heavy, you know, gnashing of teeth, and it really does upset me. I don't want to make light of it at all. I'm obsessed with starting with we stole their land, and there's nothing we can do about that now, but we can change the future. So tell us about the work of the Red Feather Development Group. What are you doing to bring about much needed change? And there's so many things that you see that I'm sure you want to do it all. What are you doing? Where do you even start?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd like to touch first on our history. And so when we first started, I always kind of give the analogy of we were very similar to Habitat for Humanity. We brought together volunteers from all over the country, even internationally, and we had a niche in doing straw bale construction, which is using bales of straw.
Yes.
To construct the walls of a home, and we would encase those in a clay or stucco to make them weatherproof to the elements, and we would build the homes with both tribal and non-tribal members, and our goal here was to build sustainable houses, to build healthy houses, to teach people in the communities themselves on how they could build these homes as well. And we did that for many years, but we transitioned away from building straw bale homes. The last one we built was in 2014, and just kind of quickly, the reason for that transition was kind of twofold. One was getting land in Native communities, even though there seems to be such an abundance of it, is very difficult for families that we work with on the Hopi and Navajo reservations. They call it a home site lease agreement or land assignments. So families just couldn't even get titles to lands to build a house. And secondly, as a nonprofit, we weren't able to generate enough money to build a new home for someone, so we required them to get a home loan. And because people don't technically own the land they live on, it's very difficult to get a loan from a bank because they can't collateralize it. But also, people, the unemployment rates are so high that it was, most people cannot afford one of the homes we were building, which at a subsidized rate were around $75,000. And what we saw is that we were building homes for the richest people in the community, which is not to say that they were very wealthy.
Right.
It just meant that they had decent credit and they had a full-time job. So we were seeing hundreds and hundreds of people that were asking for help with their existing homes. So we started to transition more recently to focusing on housing repairs as well as education. And I'll dive into those just a little bit more so the audience knows what Red Feather does today. So for our education, we're big fans of what we call do-it-yourself education. And this goes with the notion of we really try and design programs that focus on providing what we say hand-ups, not handouts, as much as possible, where people come to our classes and part of it will be spent in the classroom. We'll teach them skills such as home weatherization, like what it is, why it's important. And then we go out into the field, we go to students' homes, and we teach them how to do really basic home weatherization techniques, like putting up window film, the kind that you can go to your hardware store and you put it up with a blow dryer. It can turn a broken window into a sealed window. And they actually make a significant difference, how to put up weather stripping around a door to keep cold air or hot air from blowing in. We have a class called Women's Home Repair where we teach the ladies how to build. They build their own toolbox, and we teach them how to use power tools. And then we fill that tool, we fill that box that they build with a starter toolkit. And then on day two of that class, we go out in the field and we work on some really common home repair issues, maybe fixing a broken toilet, patching a roof leak. And the idea isn't to make them carpenters in any of our classes, but it's to give them the skills, the confidence to start, addressing these issues themselves, saying, hey, if the resources aren't there, the financial, which they're not, to help everyone, then you can do your best to help yourself. And so we try and give those skills to them. In all of our DIY classes, we always give the students the kits, like some sort of kit, whether it's a weatherization starter kit or the women's tool kits. We now teach a healthy heating class. They get a stove brush and different things to help protect themselves, smoke alarms, CO alarms. So in addition to our DIY education, we also teach professionals in communities. We teach, for instance, like how to do healthy home assessments to health professionals in tribal communities so that they can go in and help diagnose what in the house might be the biggest health threat to the family. And that might be, something as simple and obvious as mold or a tripping hazard to an elder. Then we have our Native Home Resource Network, and essentially that's a case management program where families will come to us and they'll say, I need a new roof, and we will work with them, and we'll look first at the family. What resources do you have? Is someone in the family, maybe someone's a builder, as I highlighted earlier, or maybe they just need if they're a builder, then maybe we can just get the materials donated to them. Sometimes we will do, maybe they don't have any resources and they're an elder, but if they're willing to tell us their story and we can create a crowdfunding campaign for them, then we consider that an equal form of reciprocity, and we can take their story and share it and try and raise the funding necessary to help them with their housing repairs. Sometimes we'll get volunteers. In fact, we get tons of requests for volunteers. We can't always use them, but for folks that have building skills, we can refer them to a family in need, and that volunteer labor can help that family. Sometimes we get stoves donated or windows donated, and we can give those materials to families that have come through our Native Home Resource Network. We also work with Arizona power company, APS, here, and we have a service contract with them to do home weatherization work for low-income families at Hopi and Navajo. So with that, we employ a full-time Hopi crew which is great because we're creating some jobs locally. And they go in and they can add insulation to homes. They can do what we do in the DIY weatherization class and thing and way beyond, more technical work. And then occasionally for elders that come to us, people that simply they don't have any resources themselves, and if we happen to have the funding, we can help people with kind of the full suite of services. So doing the home assessment for them, helping them find contractors, and then actually managing the contractors and implementing the work. Often we've been doing a lot of aging-in-place improvements, so building handicap ramps is one of the big things we've been doing, installing grab bars in homes for tribal elders. And a part of this is stemmed off of the healthcare agencies that are at Hopi and Navajo have told us that their number one reason for admittance into their facilities is due to tribal elder falls.
Wow.
And many people know a fall for an elder, a broken hip, can lead to, it's the beginning of the end. So if we can prevent people from falling, if we can help elders stay in their homes as long as possible, and it's a, like I could go on and on, but for elders, tribal elders specifically, like that have spent their entire lives living on their native homelands, having to leave there and go stay in a nursing home somewhere else away from their native homelands could be a worse health effect mentally to them than a broken hip. So we're doing everything we can to focus our attention on elders and prioritizing, you know, their needs, because the requests we get for help are so overwhelming that, you know, we have to make some prioritizations. And
I can't even imagine on any given day. I can't. You just have to look at what you can accomplish and not what all needs to be, or it would shut you down. I mean, it's like, what can we accomplish today that's going to move it forward? And, you know, my next question, I think you answered, because I am a big fan of the Howery grant process, not just what Mrs. Howery left for her legacy to bring about change in the sustainability and socially just spaces, but their process is really about systemic change, about authentic relationship building and engagement. And you do that. If you're doing it DIY and having women's workshop, you're doing the teaching them to fish, not giving them a fish. Is that fair?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We see it as so important. But, you know, we also wrestle with it, like, kind of morally, because there's so many people that have, they call it historic trauma, that have been traumatized by colonialization. They've been traumatized by growing up in poverty, and, you know, we talk about a cyclical process. It's very difficult to get out of. And, you know, we have families that we encounter, and that unfortunately, you know, it's very difficult for them to help themselves. And we still have compassion towards those people as well. So my point here is, wherever possible, we are focusing on how can this be a reciprocal relationship?
Right.
How can we provide hand up? But we also see people that they just need some help. And often, you know, we're also willing to provide that in certain scenarios where, hey, we're here to help.
Just do it.
We understand, how difficult it is and the things that your community have gone through and why you're in the situation that you're in.
And that makes so much sense. Sometimes it's just like, no, don't teach them. They're hurting. Help right now. It's. I feel that about, you know, kids that are hungry or kids that need a dentist. It's great to go in with a dental hygiene class, but get them to the dentist first and get that rotten tooth out. It's the same thing. Stop the suffering, and then there's an opportunity for more learning. You know, it's very early on. I know a year is not a lot of time. A year and a half isn't. When you're talking about such massive need, like almost overwhelming need, and have you been able to observe some changes that have come about as a result of the investment of the Howery grant? I mean, I wouldn't expect, you know, mind-blowing numbers, because good stuff takes time, but are there things that you feel this contribution has helped and will bring about longer-term change?
Yes, absolutely. And I should definitely talk more about the impact of the Howery Grant and exactly what it was. So the Howery Grant came about stemming back to, you know, Redfeather, our experience in houses, and seeing all these homes that were using coal specifically in their homes. At Hopi, there was 70% of families that were, or 70% of their heating fuel was coal. The rest was wood. Very few families were using electricity in their homes to heat it because it's so expensive. And coal was provided through what's known as the Kayenta mine, which powered Navajo Generating Station. That recently closed. Many people may be aware of that, which has had major significant impacts on the tribe. The Hopi tribe, 70% of their operating revenues came through NGS, and those funds have disappeared. And that free fuel source has disappeared. So we, recognizing families were suffering from asthma, they were heating their homes with coal and didn't have any other options, we approached Howery for some funding to develop a new education class, the DIY Healthy Heating class. And that class, its intent was, number one, was to build awareness of the impacts of indoor air quality on your health. Number two, was to teach people how to maintain their stove. So recognizing, hey, we didn't know at the time if coal was going away, but if you're going to burn coal or if you're going to burn wood, how do you properly maintain your stoves? And the third part of that was, if you don't want to do that anymore, what are the alternatives, forms of heat you can use for your house? So that funding from Howery enabled us to develop this class. And we delivered it for the first time last year, and it was just to show the impact of the class. Like, as soon as we started advertising the class, and we typically can take around 15 people per class, and we did the class two times last year. We had over 50 people on a wait list wanting to take the class. So Redfeather already has a reputation of helping the community and providing people know our classes, and so it was a nail on the head as far as everyone was super concerned. Like, everyone is, I mean, our phone is these days is constantly ringing off the hook because now the mine is closed, coal has gone away, families are starting, the easiest thing for them to turn to is wood. They're calling us for access to wood or for, hey, can you help me with a new heating system? We've heard about your alternative heatings. But circling back quickly, so we just delivered a class the other day, and it's the same scenario now. Our classes are packed to capacity, our heating class, and we can't serve all the people that want the information that we're trying to provide. So people are absorbing this information, they're paying attention, and something that has come to light to us now that is just super, super alarming is that because coal is no longer available, and it goes back to why Redfeather was founded, families are actually concerned with freezing to death. Again, Hopi areas, parts of Navajo, there's not a readily accessible source of firewood. So there, people are desperately looking how are they going to heat their homes? So they're buying space heaters at Walmart, which is great because a space heater only costs $20, but as soon as you plug it in, your electric bill, if you're fortunate to have electricity, shoots up to $300. It could be as high as $300-$400 a month to heat your home with electric bills. But if you're unemployed, how are you supposed to afford that? So something else that we've been doing in conjunction with the heating class, and we were really fortunate that Howery gave us an additional pot of funding to create a heating demonstration site. And this demonstration site showcases some of the alternative technologies we discovered while we were developing the DIY class. And so it showcases what's known as solar heating. Solar heating is a free source of heat. The downside to it is it only works during the day, but you can imagine if you can heat your house in the daytime, and if you don't have to burn wood in the daytime, or if you don't have to run your space heater in the daytime, then that's, you know, you reduce those utility costs or you reduce that negative air quality impact that could come from the particulates from wood burning. So that's one technology we're showcasing, and we're really interested in trying to get into more houses. At this point, we're in the process of testing it. We're installing several pilots in multiple homes, and we want the community to raise their hands and say, yes, that's a technology we're interested in. I sign me up for one of those. And people are starting to do that based on the demos we're doing. The other technology we're showcasing is known as a mini split heat pump. A heat pump produces, it does use electricity, but it does so at a fraction of the cost of space heaters, 50% exactly. Or not exactly, but thereabouts. And it's very low maintenance. They don't have to deal with if you have a heat pump, you don't have to deal with storing wood. If you're elderly, it operates with the press of a remote. It improves indoor air quality because it's electric heating. There's no emissions. The only emissions would be at the power plant that's producing the electricity. So it's both of those things are helping with reducing the even though it's on a very, very small scale, but it's a start on the impacts of climate change if families aren't using fossil fuels in their house at a localized level. If folks were ever out at Hopi, on the Hopi Reservation in the past, the air was always so thick with the smell of coal smoke. Like you could just walking around, it was almost like for me, when I'm out in the community having that smell, even though knowing it's detrimental to health, it was a sense of, even though it's not my home, Hopi, it was like a sense of home,
right?
Smelling that in the air, and that's disappearing because families don't have that access to coal anymore.
Go ahead, definitely.
Okay, yeah, great. So, even though there isn't wood per se out at Hopi, Northern Arizona we live in the largest contiguous ponderosa forest in the world. So there's ample firewood within proximity to Hopi. It's, you know, or to Navajo areas in western Navajo, so 2 hours away. And as folks probably know, we have a forest crisis. We have our forests in Northern Arizona are very overgrown. We have catastrophic wildfires because instead of having 40 to 60 trees per acre, we have, you know, 200 to 1,000 trees per acre. So there's big efforts to do thinning projects. And I know that the Forest Service is trying to work with the tribes to figure out how to get some of those forest thinnings out to the communities. So, as much as we want to see renewable technologies out there, because for all the things I've been talking about, wood is very accessible. Culturally, it's very accepted. So if they can get wood out there, it is a really good thing. And we're trying to work and get some wood supply out this season just to help families that are in emergency situations. But something that is very concerning is that folks that were burning coal produces zero creosote. Creosote is basically the burn byproduct of wood that goes up into the flue and chimney system. Because now that folks are switching to wood, there's a very high chance that we're going to see a huge jump in chimney fires and house fires on the Hopi and Navajo reservations that are switching to wood. That goes back to our class. Like in our class, we teach about stove maintenance and how to clean your stove. Because, you know, if people don't do it and your house burns down because of it, then you're in a real pickle. We're super concerned about that. And one of the things that we keep seeing is, so a lot of families, the stoves that they use in their houses, they're very old stoves. Many of them are, you know, kind of almost jokingly look like they're from Civil War times, but, jeez, you know, 30, 40, 50-year-old stoves. And we've been focusing a lot of attention on the stove, but all the experts we're talking to are telling us it's the flue systems that are the priority, then the stoves. And we often see, like the class we just did on Wednesday this week, when we went to the field part and we went into the homes to look at the stoves so people could, we can talk about an actual stove in someone's house and tell people what's good about it, what's bad about it. It was what's known as a single-walled pipe all the way through the roof, which you should never have a single-walled pipe going through your roof. You should have what's called, you should have a chimney or a double-walled pipe. If you have a single-walled pipe, your chance of a fire is highly significant. And given the fact that they're switching the wood, the only reason she had this lady that we visited, she hadn't had a fire to date, was because she's been using coal with no creosote. But now we went to her house and she was very proud of her new wood pile. But that wood pile is going to keep her warm until she sets her home on fire.
Yeah.
So now we have the dilemma of, hey, we're telling people, you know, we're trying to get wood out there to save lives, but we're also increasing a new risk.
And, you know, I just think about the Mrs. Howery listening to this and smiling for what the legacy she left has been able to do. And a lot of the listeners don't know, but you went for a seed grant and then they have a challenge grant. So I'm right here on the air, and I know some of the Howery people will listen to me. I'm lobbying for you to make sure you do a challenge grant when the time is right, because that's what they want to do. A seed grant is to plant seeds of change, and then the challenge is to get some more money to help it become sustainable. There's so much hope in what you said, in spite of how absolutely dire and devastating it is to hear, but things like the crowdfunding, and we'll close up with that. And I just want to know, you know, I just went to this wonderful thing at the U of A. People from Planet Forward were here, and they're all about telling stories, having youth tell their stories, college kids, to move the planet forward. And I just want to ask you, what's your story? You sprinkled a little bit in there of being in the Peace Corps, so I was like, that was an aha moment, and living in Africa. And so what is your story, and why does this work call you so passionately, which it obviously does?
Well, my story is, that's right. I studied anthropology as an undergrad, to my dad's utmost frustration. wondering what I was going to do with the anthropology degree. But I did it because I've always just been really fascinated by our world and the people in it. And, you know, I found the classes so fascinating. And that planted a seed in me to, you know, that, you know, as I've matured, I've learned, we all need money and we need jobs. they're important to raising successful families. But you know, work was an aside. To me, I've always had a really deep passion for just humanity and meeting people and building bridges with people. And so, you know, after anthropology, I went into the Peace Corps because of that desire, and to a desire to want to help, to see different places, to experience different cultures, for selfish reasons as well, to grow myself. Shortly after the Peace Corps, I went back to school and I studied nonprofit management and international affairs through a master's in public affairs program at the University of Arizona, with the notion that I wanted to continue in the Peace Corps vein of doing development work overseas, working, you know, I had aspirations to work for USAID or an NGO globally. And I did a little bit of that, or I had the opportunity to work for the United Nations Environment Program during my master's program. And when I came back, and I'm going to eliminate a little bit of life's journeys here, but
this is not a tell-all.
I realized that, you know, I had some experiences with Native communities, and I realized that I didn't need to go overseas to do very similar work. I mean, a lot of what I learned in development work, it applies very well. You know, working with, I'm non-native, but so working with different cultures that are separate from mine, and a lot of the challenges that Hopi and Navajo communities are facing are unfortunately similar to some countries in Africa and other places across our globe. So, you know, I was able to get to live in the beautiful town of Flagstaff and be able to work with these amazing communities, these amazing people that, despite their housing disparities and some of the social challenges that they're facing, you know, in many ways, they're getting things a lot more. They're living lives that, you know, I'm envious of. Their connection to the land, their connection to family. And I just, every time I'm out there, I always, you know, when I introduce myself and when I'm doing stuff, I always tell people how privileged I am and how respectful I am to be able to be there with them. And one of the things that, you know, I really like about what we do at Red Feather, and we pride ourselves on it, and we take every step possible to do this, is that we're not designing and bringing programs to the community from some textbook or from, you know, the high towers of academia. We start at the very bottom, you know, going into people's homes and talking with them, holding community meetings, meeting with community leaders and even up to through tribal governments. And our programs are definitely based on what the community wants and what they're and them telling us how Red Feather can help.
Right.
And you know, the only thing I wish we could do more of was help more people. But you know, we're a tiny organization. We have a staff of five people, and of six people. I'm sorry. But we have, I believe when we do tackle a challenge and the work that we do, we do a great job at it. And, you know, I can't imagine doing anything else.
Well, it's a great story. And you're right about, like, think globally, but act locally. And there's so much to be done right here in this country. And this is one of those interviews where I could actually do the call to action, and maybe you'll let me have a shot at it and see if I missed anything, because I have a question about that. We like to end with a call to action. Sometimes I don't, because it's not like intuitive or obvious to me. But to me, I wanted to ask you, if I sign up for your newsletter, do you send out announcements about crowdfunding? Is that one of the ways that you get the word out about crowdfunding?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up for our newsletter, it won't necessarily always come through a newsletter, but if you sign up, then we have your email. And I promise all the listeners that we're actually really poor about sending out newsletters because we're so busy doing work on the ground.
Got it.
We'd like to do four a year, but we're lucky if we do two newsletters a year. But we are trying to be very active on social media. We definitely post crowdfunding things to our Facebook page. We just recently started Instagramming, so it's new to us, the Instagram world, but we're trying to do more there. But yeah, signing up, getting on our Facebook page and liking us is a great way to see you know, our weekly projects and the things that we're doing. And to hear about crowdfunding campaigns. And of course, you know, we'd like to do more on our website. It's not quite where we'd like it to be, but we will post stuff there as well. And folks can go to, that's where you can sign up for our newsletters, is on Red Feather's
and
website.
And to your point, it all takes work. It all takes many hands. Believe me, we're not out teaching classes, but even at Mrs. Green's World, the newsletter is a heavy lift. It's a lot of work, and we do two a month, and we're talking about changing that. So, and I always want to reiterate to our current listeners and to anyone that's a new listener, welcome, that everything that Joe talked about, we'll put a Facebook link to their page, an Instagram link, a link to their website so that you don't have to worry about it while you're listening. And hopefully a lot of you will be inspired to get involved in some little way. I mean, if there's a crowdfunding and they get $100 or $200 or $300 from Mrs. Green's World Tribe, that's a thing. And everybody could probably pitch in $5. So, Joe, if there's not anything else that you want to say, I love having the last word, and I'm very open about it. It's like, yeah, I always wanted to have the last word in my family. And with six of us, that was a rarity. So maybe that's why I'm so obsessed with it. So is there anything I missed that you think you wish I had asked?
No, I'm sure this could be like a Joe Rogan podcast, and we could talk for two and a half hours.
Oh, but what a great analogy!
I encourage,
it's so true. Yeah. It's like, okay, I could ask a bunch more questions, but this was really good.
Yeah, I'll let you have the last word. I'll just say, you know, this is my first podcast, and it's been fun, and I really appreciate the opportunity, and thank you so much.
Well, it's been great to listen. So, my last word, as people have reflected back to me, is definitely from the heart. So quite honestly, it's really hard for me personally to get my head around our treatment of the American Indian. This really is their land. They really were here first. And there really shouldn't be any Columbus Day because, in fact, Columbus did not discover America. And I'm not sure what I can do about any of that. But what I can do is interview people like Joe Seidenberg to learn about the important and impactful work of the Red Feather Development Group. Mrs. Green's World can be part of spreading the good news about good people and mission-based organizations who are on the scene every day helping to bring about much-needed change. We can help educate people about what is and invite them to think about how things might be because we all need to have hope. Being sad and despondent about how things happened in the past doesn't really serve anyone very well, and I have to remind myself of that. What serves us all very well is to literally be the change that we wish to see in the world, to become engaged in changing things we are passionate about, to support organizations we believe are doing the good work, moving us all to a world that works for everyone. I, for one, I'm never going to give up on that dream, and I hope you won't either. Joe, thanks again for sharing all of your wonderful work with us. It was a great interview. I hope our paths cross again, and I wish you continued success going forward. And I always close with a big, heartfelt thanks to our wonderful listeners for being a part of my world. So, Joe, thanks. Sincerely, it was a great time spent.
Awesome. Thank you.